Our first session of the afternoon is Amanda Bevan, who's going to be talking about prize papers in the High Court of Admiralty.
Actually, I've got a fancier title than that. Cataloguing HCA prize papers and captured papers, or Britannia rules the waves but does not waive the rules. Probably heard me talking about Chancery records and the kind of records that Andy Wood was talking about before lunch. I have been working on those with my colleagues for some years now. We're still working on them, but I've had to divide my attention over the last year with the High Court of Admiralty records as well. If you've never heard of the High Court of Admiralty, I wouldn't be surprised. I was only really vaguely aware of it until about 2 years ago. I knew it was complicated and difficult, and my colleague Alistair Hanson knew all about it, but then he retired and promptly died, so we lost our source of knowledge on it. In the meantime, lots and lots of European scholars have been working on the records of this court because they are an absolute treasure chest of material that has been relatively unknown until now about European expansion across the world, colonisation, business. Amazing, amazing stuff. Anyway, let's dive in to the High Court of Admiralty. With a suitably nautical theme, we here we have some of the things that the High Court of Admiralty might deal with. This is HMS Sappho capturing the Danish naval brig, the Admiral Juhl, in 1808. This is a naval ship capturing another naval ship. You also get British privateers capturing merchant ships. This is three British privateers, all quite small, capturing a much larger Spanish ship in 1746. This kind of activity goes on in wartime. If it's not going on in wartime, it's called piracy. If it's going on in wartime, it's regulated. Naval ships can capture any ship. British privateers or merchant ships carrying a letter of marque have to be authorised by the High Court to go out and capture ships. They do it because there's money in it. The Navy would say they do it for duty, but they always have money in it as well. Because if you capture a ship and its cargo, and it's proved to be something called good prize, that is, you've fulfilled all the rules and regulations, you can sell it and its cargo and make pots and pots of money, like golden showers and streams of money. This is the High Court of Admiralty. It's in Doctors' Commons, so it's actually a place where probably most people will know it because of the Prerogative Court of Canterbury also sits in the same place, in a different court, but in the same building. It only sits in wartime, this bit, the prize court, and it has to judge if a captured ship and cargo is good prize and could be sold. And if it's not good prize, then you have to make restitution to the owners. So really, if you capture an enemy ship or possibly a neutral ship carrying enemy goods, you may be on your way to make your fortune, or you may be on your way to have to pay lots of costs and charges further down the line. Anyway, what we're looking at here is a period called, I'm calling the long 18th century, which is between about 1665 and 1817, during which time there were 10 wars and about 75 years of warfare. So for about half this period, we were actually at war, and British naval ships and British privateers were scouring the oceans looking for foreign ships to capture. And foreign ships were scouring the oceans looking for British ships to capture, because this is not a unique court. Similar courts exist throughout Europe, but I think all the European historians who've worked on this say that this court is unique because it's kept far more of its papers than any other Admiralty court across Europe has done. So it's not a unique court in its jurisdiction, but it is a unique court in its record keeping. So what happens? A ship is stopped or captured and the ship's papers are inspected. Ships have to carry papers to say who they are, who the owners are, what the cargo is, who the crew is, etc. And the British gave themselves kind of like what you might call stop and search powers across every ship on the high seas. We were recognised as being particularly gung-ho about this. We really gave ourselves airs and graces more than other nations did, and we felt that we had an absolute right to stop any ship on the high seas. If it was a friendly ship or a neutral ship and it wasn't carrying warlike stores, it could be let go. If it is an enemy ship or a neutral carrying warlike stores, and that can be quite a wide definition of warlike stores, it will be taken as a prize. The captors of the ship will collect and inspect all papers on the ship, and that includes any mail which is on the ship for delivery. Okay, if you think about it, the European diaspora across the world, how do they keep in contact? They keep in contact by sending letters. There is no formal mail service. They hand the letters to the nearest ship's captain going in roughly the right direction. And ships would be carrying sometimes 1,000, 2,000 bundles of letters. So, you know, it's quite a lot of material. What you do find is that ships have a standing kind of order, certainly British ships do, and I imagine the foreign ships do as well, that if you're captured, almost, and certainly if you're a naval ship, the first thing you have to do is throw the papers overboard. And they tend to do this wrapped around a lead line or something so that they sink quickly. And this is exactly the same kind of thing that should happen nowadays if a ship were to be captured. You destroy any evidence possible. It happened throughout the First War, the Second War. One of the things about the Enigma machine was that they managed to capture a submarine before the papers had been, it's not exactly thrown overboard, put into the sea. So you can see that it's really valuable kind of stuff to get, especially if it's a naval ship, because you might get enemy codes and signals and things like that. Anyway, the captors search for hidden papers or any evidence of status, of legal status of the ship. And they search quite hard, and they look in things like boys, because quite often a maritime boy I'm talking about here, quite often they would have a secret compartment in the boy, and they would put the papers in there, and if they tossed it overboard, they stood a good chance of retrieving them if they managed to convince the British ship that they were neutral. Okay, so they've thrown them away, but they might be able to retrieve them. Anyway, and then the captors will sail the ship to a friendly port with a prize crew. If it's anywhere near the British Isles, they'll sail it to the British Isles. If it's not, they'll sail it to the nearest colonial port, or in the case of our allies, Portugal, our long-term allies, Portugal, they'll sail it to a Portuguese port, because we have kind of like reciprocal arrangements with Portugal. They put on a small crew to sail it there. They take some of the officers with them. We're not exactly sure what they do with the rest of the crew, but they probably absorb them into the captor's crew. And this is the kind of things they take. They take ship's logs and papers. They take officers' own archives, because you can imagine if you're on a ship, you're going to treasure any letters written to you, you're going to have your own paperwork. Quite often, if you're a young officer, you're accumulating evidence of your experience, so you will have paperwork from previous ships. And you even have a nice quill pen there. I don't know if you can see it, but this is an actual 18th century quill pen. And also these undelivered letters. Here is a kind of like a random box of them. Some of these are completely unopened, you know, still sealed up. You get like a packet, and inside you can see that there's probably like 12 more letters inside the packet. So they're there for onward delivery. When you get to the port, and this is particularly in this country now, you have the same system of commissioners taking depositions that Andy mentioned earlier. Every port, no matter how small, has got some local person who has been authorised by the High Court of Admiralty to ask a set series of questions of the people who have been brought in to give evidence, that's the original crew, and of possibly one crew member of the officer who's brought the ship in. And they have like 32 questions that they ask, and the first one is, of what country are you a subject? Who is your ruler? Are you a member of a city corporation? Like if, say, you're in the Hanseatic League, are you a burgher of Hamburg or whatever? Then there's other questions about what was the situation when the ship was captured? Where was it captured? Where was it going? How was it captured? What cargo are you carrying? And then the question that we found very useful is, what papers were you carrying and what has happened to them? So that gives us a clue when things have been just destroyed. The prize commander testifies about the capture and also about any papers. And then, so from Plymouth or Lowestoft or Dover, all this paperwork, the answers to the deposition, you know, the answers taken to these questions and the papers from the ship are sent up to the High Court of Admiralty in London. They're usually kind of like trussed up in a parcel of sailcloth, High Court of Admiralty written on it in bold, and up it's sent by stagecoach. At the High Court of Admiralty, which is just close to St Paul's Cathedral, the case begins, and a public notice of the capture, which is called a monition, it's kind of like an advertisement, was displayed at the Royal Exchange. This is the old Royal Exchange, also very near St Paul's Cathedral. And it's put up there so that all the merchants in the City of London go past it regularly and they will look and see, is there any ship captured to which I or any of my partners across Europe might have a claim to the cargo or a claim to the ownership of the ship? and people could put in a claim to say, it might be a neutral ship carrying some warlike stores, but it's also carrying my completely unwarlike and proper trade, and I want to claim this part of the cargo back. I think probably about 75% of these ships weren't contested at all, and there was just absolutely clear that it was an enemy ship. One of the things that makes it absolutely clear that it's an enemy ship is if it puts up a fight of any kind. So if you're hoping to get away with being thought to be a neutral, you don't put up a fight. And the idea that there's kind of like big battles to capture these ships is not really accurate. Most ships just kind of like surrendered at the first opportunity. The ships are quite valuable in themselves, but the cargo is much more valuable. They're merchant seamen. It's pointless putting up a defence against being captured, because in very many occasions you might be recaptured by your own side about 2 weeks later. And that happens with surprising regularity. Anyway, what does the High Court of Admiralty do with these papers? Well, first of all, it uses them to prove the national status of any claimants, the owners of the ship or the cargo. They look at things like, what's your allegiance at birth? Are you resident in an enemy state, or are you just passing through? And have you got any strong attachment to a claimed neutral abode? If you say that you are a Danish person and that you live in Copenhagen when you're not at sea, and yet your wife has been writing to you from an Amsterdam address for the last 7 years, are you really Danish and neutral, or are you really Dutch and an enemy? And even though if you start out Danish, you can become Dutch just by living in a country. So you can see this is really quite interesting for the history of ideas of nationality and how people move from kind of like subjects to citizens of other countries, and the idea of how national status can vary considerably. I mean, you get some people who are born in one place, have lived in that place all their lives when they're not at sea, and yet during that time, they have been the subject of a completely different sovereign on something like 4 occasions. As their city has been captured, they stop being Danish and they become German. As the city is recaptured, they might become Swedish. It's all over the place, really. And it's quite intriguing to see how fluid it was then and how kind of like cut and dried it is now. Now, these kind of pile here, these are notes taken in court of what the judges were thinking and about their arguments that they're making. It's quite clear from these and also from these 6-volume reports of cases heard in the High Court that the judge is looking very, very closely at this documentary material. They are making really quite sophisticated arguments based on what they're reading. So the court is using this material. It's not just that... I'm hammering this point home a little bit because many of our European researchers thought, oh, the High Court of Admiralty didn't know what to do with it, just chucked it in a corner, never took any notice of it, etc., etc. They did. They knew exactly what they were doing with it and they kept it for a purpose. So it's not just that the British record-keeping system was based on laziness and not knowing what to do. It was actually based on using these things. And what do they do with the papers? Well, you get two sets of records now. One called HCA 32, which is the working papers on which the court based its judgment. So they actually had a look at the papers that had come off the stagecoach, and they went through them and they worked out, I'll need this, this, and this to prove enemy status. But there's lots of other material as well, like all these potential letters and other things and people's own archives. And they don't throw it away, and I think that's the big difference between us and other courts in Europe. They didn't throw it away, and the reason they didn't throw it away is they think, we'll hang on to it just in case there's an appeal further down the line, because we might need further evidence. So they put it in what they nicely called miscellanea, which is a series called HCA 30 now. And over time, the link between the two has got lost. That's the kind of like the court papers tied up in a typical bit of pink legal ribbon. That's the red tape. These are the letters tied up in a bit of archive tape. So they've got something like 26,000 ships' papers and something like 85,000 letters from possibly about 500 ships which didn't throw the mail away. This was the level of cataloguing. We can call it cataloguing, but it's not really, is it? This is HCA 32, ships beginning K, captured in 1793. Not really very illuminating. The letters in HCA 30, the miscellaneous class, were a bit better because at least they gave some ideas to nationality. So they were just described as like Danish or Dutch or French or in one case Spanish and Armenian. But again, it's not really very informative. So what we're trying to do at the moment is we're trying to create a brief listing of all the captured ships. We want to work out a, we could call it a simple but robust referencing system. And the reason we want to do this is the European researchers have been busy devising their own and have published, and they've cited these in a very odd kind of way. And the court gave each kind of like ship's dossier a number, but that's always been ignored, and they've gone for things like the big box, the small box, and stuff like that, and incorporated this into their referencing system. So we want to give them a nice referencing system which is simple to understand and gets you directly to the ship involved. And then we want to identify those ships which are carrying mail and papers where the mail survives, ready for future work. This is what we've done so far. Quite typically, we've gone back to the court's own original finding aids. You can see that this one has been rearranged lots of times. So that it was originally called Box 23 in such lovely fancy writing, they must have had time on their hands. It's now, we're using this number down here, bundle 722, and then 123, etc. So we have the name of the ship, and we have the name of the master. That was 19,000 ships. We're currently working on a chunk in the middle of the 18th century, where there's fewer ships, nearly just about 3,500 maybe, but there was a detailed draft list for these which has been sitting in a record series called OBS, obsolete indexes, abandoned work, that kind of stuff. And then before that, for the previous wars, which is kind of like the late 17th century, early 18th century, there's no index, there's no detail, we've got to do it all from scratch. Now, this is the person who did the lovely card index, very, very detailed card index, lovely stuff in it. His name is Charles Gascoigne. And he was a scholar of the High Court of Admiralty. He taught at Cambridge in wartime, in the First World War and the Second World War. He worked on postal censorship, which I think is just kind of like, you know, every bit of his life is soaked in this kind of thing. When he retired from all of this, he came to work at the Public Record Office, lived at the Athenaeum, worked at the Public Record Office, and he went through these two wars and created lots and lots of detailed listing. One of the things he did, which we wouldn't do now, is having identified which ship a set of mail had come from, he put them back together. So he took it out of the miscellaneous series and he put it back with the original court papers for the ship. And that's something we wouldn't do now because we now understand that the court papers are what was actually used in court and the other material is just what was on the ship and wasn't used for the legal argument. Unfortunately, although he had this grand plan, he died before completing the moves, leaving a very complicated set of finding aids, with a note, there is no duplicate of this schedule, so heaven preserve it. And that's what we've been working on. So we've done 2,500 of these, and volunteers are now checking and labelling them, so they'll be available shortly. This is the kind of material that he provided in the new listing. So we get the name of the ship, the Walpole, the master, Julien Tanquerel, obviously being captured by the French. Previously, with a name like Walpole, the master was English, William Jackson. So we get a little history of the ship. A French ship, formerly English, merchant ship, captured by the French privateer La Grande Biche, retaken by the Greyhound privateer, recaptured by French privateers and carried to Newfoundland, finally retaken by HMS Fly. And of all that going backwards and forwards, the only person who has the only ship that has a claim to the value of this prize will be HMS Fly. And the documents include allegation, claims, examinations, and ship's papers, so it gives you a good idea of what's there. Some of them are more complicated, like this one, the Franciscus. This is where he's added the extra information. This is a Hamburg merchant ship going from Tenerife in the Canary Islands, alleged to be going to Dunkirk. As well as the court papers, it contains the master's valuation of the ship, bills of lading about this cargo, correspondence from Tenerife to London, Hamburg, Amsterdam, etc., miscellaneous papers, letters from English, Irish and other merchants, specimens of cloth, a printed papal bull and violin music. And in a little while we're going to hear one of the papers, one of the letters taken from this ship, just to give you a flavour of what they're like. Now we're busy surveying the captured letters and papers in the miscellaneous series HCA 30, thanks to the Friends of the National Archives who provided funding for us to do this, and Randolph is busy sorting out something like 2,000 letters from one ship, at the moment. He uses evidence like this to try and work out what the ship is. This one says, par le navire le grand don de Dieu, and then the captain's name, so that's quite easy to say, yes, this mail came from this ship. But quite often he has to go and look through the court papers just to try and work out what on earth this completely unnamed ship was that's got all these papers on it. There's lots and lots of technical vocabulary. At the moment we've got up to a dozen languages and counting. I think this one is Arabic. And we have lots of problems with it. There's kind of like inherited papers. So you've got the name of a ship which was never actually captured. We know it was never captured because it sank. Okay, so... But the person who was on it but then went on to serve on another ship and has taken his papers with him. We have lots of papers where there's more than one ship in a box. That sounds odd, but, you know, the papers are from one ship in a box. And sometimes the papers of one ship might be split amongst several boxes. So we've got 85,000 letters as yet. We know that they're there by number, but we don't know what's in them. And so what I'm going to do is to play you a film from the Franciscus, the ship going from Tenerife to Dunkirk, from a young Irishman living there, sent home to Waterford in Ireland. And it's about his very, very sad story of a string of misadventures rather than adventures.
For Mr. Morris O'Hearn, merchant in Ireland, to be delivered to his bookkeeper, Mr. James Wise of Waterford. To Mr. James Wise, Santa Cruz, Tenerife, the 18th of May, 1744. Dear and ever-loving cousin, I've seen a great deal of the world since I had the pleasure of seeing you, having met with a great many ups and downs, I've had considerable losses and disappointments, all of which I received from the hand of God with the Christian conformity I was capable of. And with great reason, for by his divine providence I once escaped being lost in the Barbary coast, and another time from being murdered in the port Orotava by a townsman and pretended relation of ours, one William Hayes, a periwig maker, whom stabbed me maliciously in the street at night with a sword, and wounded me to that degree in the left shoulder that I had liked to bleed to death. The knave was bearing at me, and I defended him with my feet and hands, which was all the arms I had then about me. I was taken up by the notary public, who was so charitable as to bring me to his house and send for the doctor to dress the wound, and for a confessor to comply with the rites of the church. But thank God, the wound happened to be in a good place, where it was easily cured in the space of 20 days. All which misfortunes made me take a resolution of embarking to the Spanish West Indies. And I accordingly came from Orotava to this port of Santa Cruz in December last. I was depending on the general administrator's word, whom promised to procure me my passage down to Campechia near Mexico. But when it came to the push that the vessels were ready to sail, I found myself deceived by said gentleman, whom I served as a secretary for 10 months. So I went supercargo of a French brig, and bound hence to Barbary, and from thence for St. Pierre in Martinico. But unfortunately the vessel sprung a leak, loaded with Barbary ham, 25 leagues from the port, so that we were obliged to throw our chests, wherein our clothes were, and the cargo overboard. We had the like to perish. You'll see by my father's letter how we escaped, and how I was left naked, save only a morning gown and 2 shirts I had on my back when the misfortune happened. On my arrival from Barbary to this port of Santa Cruz, I was obliged to come ashore at night in my gown, for I couldn't come in the day for the want of clothes. I went to our French vice consul's house, where I still remain, tutoring his 2 bastard sons and doing anything else he has to be done without a farthing piece in consideration of my labour, save only my diet, washing and lodging. Dear cousin, I write this occasion to my father and mother earnestly, praying of them to send me a bill of £12 sterling on this island. I'm persuaded what you'll say in my behalf on this subject will weigh a great deal on my good father, wherefore I shall esteem your good office and endeavour herein. I will be infinitely obliged, for I protest to God I never wanted it more, being as aforesaid naked without a dollar in my pocket, which I hope you'll make my father take into consideration. I still imagine you with me. Notwithstanding Providence, we may still be serviceable to each other, though in remote and different parts of the world. As for my part, I have all the desire possible to demonstrate the friendship and love we have compacted together. I am with profound regard and embraces to your father and mother, sir, your most humble servant and cousin, William Farrell. P.S. The King of Spain has given license to the Lord Lieutenant of these islands to admit all effects from Great Britain arriving under neutral colours. Please send 150 barrels of good beef, butter in a cask, 250 boxes of common candles, 10 barrels of soap made up in beef barrels, 12 boxes of tongues well pickled and made up with saltpetre, as much beeswax as you can find, 250 tan sole leather hides of the smallest size.
I hope you'll agree with me that William Farrell, I think, deserves to be heard again. His letters for help were never received by his family, and I think, goodness knows what happened to him. There he was, stuck on Tenerife with no clothes, no money, no hope, but still trying to turn a quick buck or two right at the end of that letter. And I think you'll agree that these kind of letters deserve to be more widely heard.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.